stealing water supplies from Palestinians in the occupied territories. Through the denial of access to water and sanitation, Mekarot collaborates with the far-right cabinet of Israel in the implementation of institutionalized water apartheid, which is a central component of Israel's policies of ethnic cleansing of Palestinian communities. We believe the deal should be scrapped.
Over the past years, companies in a number of countries, including Portugal, Argentina and the Netherlands, have pulled out of deals signed with Mekarot. The decision to sever ties with Israel's water company followed protests over Mekarot's role in Tel Aviv's water apartheid against Palestinians. Israel's Mekarot provides drinking water for Israeli settlers and infrastructure for water supplies in the illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Not only Israel is accused of manipulating water supplies, but it also prohibits the construction of water networks to provide drinking water in cities and villages. Humanitarian organizations accuse Israel of violating Palestinians' rights, included in several international agreements and conventions.
Israel is stealing all the water of Palestine. Mekarot has been signing deals with many international companies across the world, and now it's Italy's turn. We denounce Israel's criminal policy of water apartheid against Palestinians and will call on Italy to respect international accords.
It is estimated that while the Palestinian population of the West Bank has doubled since the Israeli occupation formally began in 1967, water allocation for Palestinians has remained at 1997 levels. It's not just the Genoa's councillors who are calling on the municipality to scrap the Iren-Mekarot deal. Councillors from the municipalities of Reggio Emilia, Turin and Parma have demanded the governments to do the same. Max Civili, Rome.
The fifth meeting of security representatives from several countries to address Afghanistan problems has been held in the Russian capital, Moscow. Participants have come up with a number of practical measures to take joint actions in the fight against terrorism. The measures include curbing terrorism finances, intensifying cooperation in the field of combating transnational organized crime, illegal arms and drug trafficking, and preventing illegal migration. The measures come at a time when the U.S. authorities are using the frozen Afghan assets as a tool to blackmail the country. In December, Russia's permanent representatives to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, called on Washington to immediately return the funds stolen from the Afghan people. He called the U.S. freezing of Afghanistan's assets outrageous. This, as Afghan authorities are still reaping the fruits of chaos left by the Americans, and the situation in the socio-economic sphere is rapidly degrading.
Washington, London and their allies continue to freeze Afghan assets illegally instead of allocating them for humanitarian works. Moreover, attempts are being made by Western countries to plunder the funds, including by setting aside part of them to pay compensation to relatives of September 11 attacks victims in which the Afghan people were not involved.
The Iranian representatives called the situation in Afghanistan a consequence of the U.S. policy.
Iran is a country hosting the largest number of refugees from Afghanistan. They are provided with a variety of opportunities, including higher education through state subsidies. Approximately 300 to 350,000 children from Afghanistan study in our schools, and about 6,000 Afghans study at Iranian universities. We do not have any camps for refugees. Afghans live on an equal footing with other Iranian citizens. We do not make any discriminatory distinction between Iranian and Afghan students. Moreover, given the difficult economic situation in Afghanistan, we grant scholarships to refugee families for the education of their children.
The secretaries of national security of the participant countries described the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan as pre-planned and prepared. Under the pretext of fighting the terrorist group that Washington itself created, the U.S. wants to force Afghanistan's neighboring countries to open their doors to American bases. That's a policy aimed at expanding the U.S. presence in the region. Such meetings are seen as an attempt to neutralize and contain the U.S. approach. The Moscow format on Afghanistan was created in 2017 that brought together Russia, Afghanistan, China, Pakistan, Iran and India. Later, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan joined as well. Participants have so far held several meetings aimed at helping Afghanistan, which has been devastated by years of the US-led war. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A conference near the UK Houses of Parliament to mark the 12th anniversary of the Bahraini people's uprising against the Al Khalifa regime. A reminder that the reverberations of what happened on Pearl Square in 2011 continue to be felt today.
There is a momentum for the revolution that the crisis has not ended. It is there. It is escalating by the day. It's not really diminishing at all. And it is our feeling that the people will not give up unless there is a good degree of concessions. And my feeling also, the regime cannot do that.
This is what it looked like when the Islamic Awakening reached the Kingdom of Bahrain 12 years ago. The protesters' main demands, socioeconomic justice and democracy. What they got from the regime, though, a state of emergency and a violent crackdown that lasted for months, aided and abetted by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Many were killed or injured, many more jailed or exiled, making Bahrain a country with one of the worst human rights records. Yet none of that impacted its relations with the corridors of power here in the UK, which lists Bahrain as a core market for its arms sales.
The relationship that the UK government has is a special relationship because historically it has been an ally of successive repressive regimes. For a single purpose, well, a dual purpose. One is obviously the issue with regard to oil, and the second is the strategic importance of Bahrain. And what we've seen is a pattern of governments, successive governments of all political persuasions, put those interests, both strategic and with regard to oil, economic, above the basic civil liberties and human rights of the people of Bahrain.
The kingdom is also host to American and British military bases. Neither country offered any support for the uprising at the time.
Bahrain has an embassy in London, and the UK is one of four European countries to maintain an embassy in Manama. The participants here say it's time the UK government rethought its cozy relationship with the regime in Manama, held it accountable, and stood up for the people of Bahrain. Saeed Bourza, London.
In recent months, Alexei Reznikov has been mixing at the highest levels within NATO and the EU. He's just been sacked as Ukraine's defense minister amid a fresh corruption scandal. There was no mention of this at a press conference following a meeting of EU affairs ministers in Brussels on Monday. It was confirmed, however, that attempts are being made to apply more pressure on Russia over the war in Ukraine.
We continue to work on the 10th package of sanctions to be in place by 24th of February, 1 year after the invasion started.
EU taxpayers have already sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine. Ministers pledged on Monday to keep the money flowing. This as mortgage repayments in the eurozone are going up after the European Central Bank increased interest rates. Citizens have been talking to us about the cost of living crisis.
I bought my house, and so it's very, very hard to pay.
My weekly bill went from 50 euros per week to 100, 150, and I live alone. So
with 50 euros, you cannot buy some food for a week. You can just buy for 1 or 2 days.
It's several hundred, definitely. Several hundred euros per month.
More than you were paying.
Yeah.
The ECB is raising interest rates to try and control inflation, but it's damaging the EU's competitiveness. There's concern employment will be impacted.
Credit to the private sector is becoming more expensive. Bank lending to firms has decelerated sharply over recent months.
Analysts say EU sanctions against Russia are backfiring as higher energy costs spread throughout the bloc's entire economy. There is no relief in sight for mortgage holders in the eurozone. The ECB has indicated it will increase rates further.
in March. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Search and rescue efforts are underway in Turkey and Syria after two massive earthquakes rattled large swathes of the two neighboring countries and left thousands dead. Rescuers are digging through piles of the rubble to find possible survivors. But the freezing weather conditions is not only hampering rescue operations, but adding misery to those who left injured or homeless. Concerns are particularly high over the situation in Syria. The natural disaster has multiple tragedies Syrians have been going through for over a decade. The devastating quake brings to the spotlight how difficult life has been for millions of those who were displaced by foreign-backed militancy and endured Western sanctions. The crippling curbs have devastated Syria's economy to the extent that the country is unable to recover and reconstruct by its own. Now the same unlawful sanctions are complicating international efforts to assist Syrians who have been affected by the latest quakes. The World Health Organization says Syria's humanitarian needs are the highest, describing the situation as a crisis on top of multiple crises.
WHO recognizes Turkey's strong capacity to respond and considers that the main unmet needs may be in Syria in the immediate and mid-term.
That assessment is echoed by other UN officials as well as rescue workers on the ground in northern Syria.
Those people already needed assistance. Now they will need more of that assistance, and they need an immediate earthquake-related assistance.
Honestly, the situation is very disastrous. It needs the interference of United Nations organizations and international organizations that are specialized in rescuing, because the situation is very harsh and people are still under the rubble from yesterday.
British activist Vanessa Bealey, who is now in Syria, says the Western sanctions could target anybody who comes to Syria's assistance.
The people who are now homeless are in the streets soaking wet and freezing cold without any alternative shelter and without any electricity, without any heating, without any fuel, because of course we don't have any heating fuel either in the country pretty much. So these shortages combined of course with the Western barbaric sanctions, including the CESAR law that was imposed by the Trump administration, which penalizes any country that even comes to the assistance of Syria. So those countries that can then be sanctioned by default if they come to the aid of Syria, which is, you know, a criminal sanctions regime to impose on any country and quite unprecedented.
Now the Syrian Red Crescent has appealed to Western countries to lift sanctions and provide aid to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The humanitarian organization has also urged the United Nations to facilitate the aid effort, particularly in the militants-held area in northwestern Syria. It says they are ready to deliver relief to those areas if militants open a road for them. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said the quick-hit areas may need years to recover from the destruction. It says long-term help will be needed and not just assistance in search and rescue operation for survivors.
They'd warned the next one would be their biggest yet, and they've kept their promise. Tens of thousands of nurses from the Royal College of Nursing Union and ambulance crews on strike, this time together.
No nurses!
No NHS!
No nurses!
The chanting on the picket lines is not just about inflation-busting pay rises, but about the depressing state of the National Health Service. ICU nurse Neve has worked for the NHS for 10 years. It explains to us why she thinks the system is in crisis.
Total underfunding, a lack of foresight, I think, politically, and nurses really just being taken for granted for too long.
And that has meant tens of thousands of trained nurses either leaving the profession or working for the private sector in recent years.
They're calling out for the National Health Service to be kept alive, a system that is now on life support. And many in the medical profession believe that the deeper the crisis gets, the stronger the likelihood that privatization will be foisted upon them.
That's because while the NHS is at breaking point, private health care is flourishing, creating worries about a two-tier system, one for the rich who can pay their way, and another one, a subpar NHS for everyone else.
I hope
that it isn't the case that we're moving towards a privatised system. I think it would be disastrous for all of us if that was the case. I think hopefully with these strikes, the public support that we've gained, the government will listen and see that that just isn't, you know, it isn't an option. People don't want to lose the NHS.
If gestures of support by passing motorists is anything to go by, public support for the strikers is strong. It remains to be seen which side the British government will decide to be on. Saeed Puriza, London.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate. Thank you.
Miss Muttley. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
News in the Ukraine war is not so much about advancements on the ground as they are about military assistance to Ukraine and Zelensky's guest appearances, like his most recent visit to the UK, then the Elysee Palace in France, and then the EU capital in Brussels, all in a span of a few days. His request, more aid and military equipment, in particular fighter jets. No surprise there. Will he get it? How much aid does he want? How many more requests and how much longer will Russia tolerate the pumping of military equipment to Ukraine, while all leaders of the Western world have said, we are with you, Ukraine, till the end? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Andriy Dobryansky, chair of the UN Affairs, the Ukrainian World Congress, joins us from New York. Also joining us, Harley Schlanger, who's at the Schiller Institute in Germany, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany. Welcome to you both. Harley Schlanger, if I may start with you first. We're taking a look at the appearances that Zelensky has made in a span of days, as I said in the intro, looking at the UK and he addressing the parliament there, then moving on to the Elysee Palace. The French president and the German chancellor were there, and, of course, the EU. Why do you think Zelensky has to make these appearances in the first place? I must add in the Oscars, Wall Street Bells when they open up, and other appearances where he has been appearing via live video stream, which in this case he didn't do in the past three appearances. What do you make of these appearances in the way that he has made them?
Well, I think he's in trouble. He's in trouble in Ukraine. He's shuffling his government. The corruption charges are starting to have some real traction. And their military has been badly damaged by the war. They're running short of ammunition. They're running short of soldiers. And the Russians are preparing an offensive. So it's not so much about Zelensky as it is NATO. Because the decision to have him come to Britain, I mean, look what he did. He met with King Charles. Boris Johnson was at his elbow every step of the way. He met with Sunak. He addressed the parliament. This is all part of a big show. A show of NATO unity. And what they're trying to do, I think, is to convince President Putin that he should back down. Now, also the discussion of the weapons. You know, there are a number of key American military experts who are saying that the tanks are going to be a while before they get there. They may not be decisive. But what Zelensky went to London, Paris, and Brussels for was fighter jets. And up to this point, the U.S. has said no to fighter jets, the Germans also. However, they've changed because they said no to tanks initially. The reason he wants fighter jets and long-range precision missiles is that he wants to target Crimea. And this is where the situation becomes extremely dangerous, because if the West crosses one more red line, and Putin has said Crimea is Russian territory and that Russia will do everything it needs to defend Russian territory.
Right.
This is pushing the situation to the brink of a much bigger war. So I think they're trying to shore up the sense of support for Ukraine. But it's also, look, there are big demonstrations in Europe now. So the situation is not so good for NATO.
Okay. Andriy Dobryansky, do you agree with the viewpoints there that Harley Schlanger relayed, especially, of course, the Ukraine stance overall?
Of course not. These appearances, as you mentioned, these are state visits. So this is the head of a state coming to several different countries. And then, as you said, in Brussels, meeting with several heads of state together, not only to have discussions. We all see the group picture at the end, but it's about the discussions, talking about how support for Ukraine will go on. and almost everybody unilaterally mentioning that they will continue to support Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. That is the way the rest of the world has seen it, and that is the way that is the only way out for the end of this war, which is Putin withdrawing his forces, not, as you mentioned, having some sort of red line. There are six territories that have been occupied by Putin's armies. There are war crimes happening on those territories every day. There is no need for the rest of the world to be okay with these war crimes. At some point, Mr. Putin and all the officers who are involved in this will be held up in some international tribunal.
All right. I'm no military expert, but this is what I'm going to ask you, and I'm wondering if you can help me out in terms of trying to figure this out. You know, we hear about these military assistance and equipment on a rather consistent and continual basis. So my question is, why not just ask all of the equipment that Ukraine needs in one swoop? Get together with the EU, with the U.S., with whatever countries, and just ask for it and make it clear as to what you're going to get and what you're not going to get. Because it seems like these are just incrementally being asked and then provided. You know, with the F-35s or with fighter jets at this point, I'm not even sure if anybody has committed to it or not. But it's something that may be committed to, just like with other military assistance where, for example, the tanks, they asked for it, they said no. Germany and the U.S. vehemently, outright rejected that idea, but then they gave in. So why not ask for all of it and for the other countries to make their mind up whether they're going to give it or not?
Well, yes, Ukraine has been asking for equipment. Some of that equipment has been passed along to Ukraine. Some of it hasn't, and then Ukraine keeps asking. So it defeats the logic of your question, saying that Ukraine should just have one list, and then it's either yes or no. The question is protecting Ukraine, protecting its sovereignty and its right to its territorial integrity. So Ukraine will keep asking so long as the West is ready to give more. We know that there's a promise from Poland to hand over fighter jets as soon as other countries are okay with that as well. We know the United Kingdom is in the same place already trading fighter pilots. So similar to the other technologies, it's a step-by-step process of international diplomacy, not just demanding things from the rest of the world. These are valid states, okay. Independent states, sovereign states, asking each other for help in this crisis.
Okay. Harley Schlanger, one of the reasons why I asked that question is because as we take a look at the requests that are being made, people are dying from both sides. People are dying in Ukraine. There are soldiers that are dying. There are people who are dying. And, of course, Russian side is also has its death toll increase as this war is dragging on. So is there, what are we getting at when it comes to the Ukrainian side asking for it and then the other side, and I'm putting them as a whole, EU, Europe, NATO countries, US, and they're not providing the military equipment at this point. I think, based on what they have said, they don't want to have that confrontation head on with Russia. Is that why they're incrementally providing Ukraine with this equipment?
Well, let me say that I think Mr. Dobryansky is right about one thing. Zelensky has been asking for this from the very beginning. He's been asking for much greater weaponry than has been provided, much more support, much more money. And the reason the West has been holding back is they're very much concerned that this is going to spin out of control. Now, one point I want to make in contrast to what he said, the rest of the world is not against Russia. One of the problems Europe has is with the so-called Global South, which refuses to give the support that's being demanded by Zelensky. Look what happened when Scholz went to Brazil recently. Lula turned him down on ammunition, turned him down on the green policy. Lula said that they want a meetings for peace. Much of the world wants peace. Zelensky doesn't. And this goes back to the whole reason why this thing started. There was an effort to get a peace agreement through Minsk, and the West lied to Russia repeatedly. And what were they doing? Why were they lying?
Right.
To have time to build up their military so they could go to war with Russia.
Can I have that part of your statement addressed to Andriy Dobryansky? Andriy Dobryansky, Zelensky
sure.
Doesn't want peace?
No, Zelensky wants peace for his people, obviously. That requires, by definition, Russia leaving the territory of Ukraine. Unless that happens, repeated war crimes will continue to happen. And these war crimes are part of the reason that the rest of the world has decided to provide more and more equipment, because they cannot stand by as women as old as 82, children as young as 4 are victims to sexual violence.
Okay.
At the same time, let me please address the rest of the world. I believe there are 3 nations from Africa on the UN Security Council, and they are part of the strongest voices condemning Russia's neocolonialism in Ukraine. So I'll make sure that the record stands that, you know, some of the strongest words I've ever heard about condemning this war come from African nations. In the case of Brazil and other South American nations, I personally know that the governor of the São Paulo province and many mayors and local administrators throughout Brazil have made numerous statements in support of the Ukrainian people. So you can't just say that, yes, one nation, in terms of its democratically elected leadership, is making one decision, but you can't say that that represents all Brazilians.
Harley Schlanger,
there's
go ahead.
There are diverse
Let Harley Schlanger respond to you then. Harley Schlanger, go ahead.
Yeah, look, the idea that 3 African nations represent a majority of Africa, much of Africa has refused to condemn the Russians for the invasion. Much of Africa, countries like Indonesia, Algeria, Nigeria, South Africa, I could go through a list, but that's not the point. You want to talk about war crimes. What about what was done against the people in the Donbas for 8 years when there was supposedly a peace process underway? I think this is a fallacy that's being presented here in terms of saying it's all Russia, it's all Russia. The Russians went in to defend people who were Ukrainian, living in the Donbas, who were of Russian descent, defend them from networks that go back and trace their roots to the Nazis in the World War II period. So if you want to talk about war crimes, let's talk about that. But in terms of the rest of the world, you have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the BRICS, you have the Eurasian Economic Union. Many countries are saying there should be peace.
Okay.
The Pope has called for negotiations. The Ukrainians say no negotiations until Russia leaves. And Putin is saying he's not leaving until there are security guarantees for the Russians who live in eastern Ukraine.
Okay.
So I think you have to look at this in a much different way than Mr. Dobryansky is looking at it.
Mr. Dobryansky, as our guests are addressed to you, let me get your reaction on what Putin said recently. Quote, those seeking to defend Russia on the battlefield apparently do not realize that a modern war with Russia would be entirely different for them. We're not sending our tanks to their borders, yet we have something to respond with, and it would not be limited to armor use only. Everyone must realize that. What do you think about that?
I think Mr. Putin's army has been shown to be a paper tiger in Ukraine. That is quite evident. That is quite evident with the tens of thousands of prisoners they rely on to field their forces on the battlefield. We've seen this as far back as the interventions in Syria as well as Georgia. In Georgia, where a MiG was shot down with a simple man pad. And we also see that Russia is afraid of using its air force because of the possible damage to it. This is not a world where combat ready force, clearly, and Ukraine has exposed it. Let me just ask you about the
hypersonic missiles that Russia has?
Yeah, they used them anywhere?
I'm sorry?
Have they used them anywhere?
Well, they've said they have them, and they said that it's, you know, I'm sure you're familiar somewhat with it. I just know that it's faster than
speed. But have they used them anywhere?
They said that they may. I'm just curious. And they may have other things in their arsenal.
And I've described them as a paper tiger. We have seen that roughly one-third of all artillery that they've used, ballistic missile that they've used, have failed. Another third have not detonated. And a third have found their target.
Okay.
So
Harley Schlanger,
this is the state of Russian technology, military technology that we're talking about.
Okay, I don't know anything about it, really. Let me have Harley Schlanger perhaps address that. Harley Schlanger, go ahead.
Well, I would disagree with his assessment of the situation. The Russians initially were hoping that they could come into Ukraine and force a negotiated agreement. The Ukrainians have, by Ukrainians, I mean the Zelensky regime, has no wish for an agreement because they're being directed by NATO. Remember, end of March last year, there was a near mediation and a negotiated settlement, and NATO sent Boris Johnson to scuttle it. There have been other efforts made to bring this about. Now, meantime, when you want to talk about the deployment of war crimes, what about the article that just came out yesterday by Seymour Hersh exposing that Biden was the one who ordered the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines, which is affecting the life of every single person in Europe. Now, what you have to look at is the European governments are holding back because they're weak, because in Paris, there were, in France rather, 3 million people in the streets last week against the war. Denmark, 60,000. We're going to see growing demonstrations against the war because it's costing a huge amount of money for something Indeed. That is not in the interest even of the Western
Sorry countries. To jump in, Harley Schlanger. I saw Andrich shake his head. Go ahead.
I know that those protests that are being mentioned, the number is obviously inflated, but those aren't necessarily protests solely against against helping Ukraine. Those are protests altogether against government involvement in a whole host of things. So that's one thing. But in terms of you know, what Ukraine is doing, Ukraine is not, and you will not see Zelensky at all these appearances, as you mentioned at the beginning, or these state-to-state visits, talking about no negotiation. Since September of last year, President Zelensky has outlined a 10-point peace plan. We would love for the rest of the world to get on board with some of these peace plans, and they don't all need to happen at the same time. I believe President Zelensky is actually willing to talk about all of these one by one, the first of which is that we should remove all military forces from the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. That is a basic tenet of all international law, and everybody should be behind that. So it's simple tenets like these that eventually lead up to his final point, which is a tribunal for all the people who have committed war crimes in Ukraine. But in terms of negotiating, okay. President Zelensky has put out a peace plan out there.
The Ukrainians who killed the people, the civilians in Donbas, should they be brought before military tribunals?
I know that there are some conspiracy theories being propagated, such as whatever blog post, as the U.S. government has mentioned, about Mr. Hirsch's quote-unquote reporting, which is all based on one anonymous source. So in terms of conspiracy theories, there's not that much that I can, you know, really talk about. But well, I can talk about...
I'm asking you about the killing that went on in the Donbas, the killing of civilians in the Donbas that went on for 8 years.
Is this something that Roger Waters testified about? Who testified about this at the UN Security Council? Roger Waters?
The people who lived there.
The people who lived there testified
the West,
to...
Who were being suppressed from talking in the West.
Testified
it's called
to the UN
a conspiracy theory.
There is a special rapporteur for war crimes in Ukraine.
Are you saying that there haven't been casualties in Donbas inflicted by Ukrainian forces? Are you saying that?
I'm saying that there's a special rapporteur
for war
crimes.
Will you go on record and say that there are no civilians killed?
I'm telling you that there's a special rapporteur for war crimes in Ukraine. All of that is laid out in public. All the reports. You can read exactly what's happening. But what you're alluding to, again, in these numerous conspiracy theories, trying to tie together some red thread on the wall, is that listening to musicians like Roger Waters, listening to film actors like Steven Seagal are the experts we should be talking to, as opposed to actually going to Ukraine and talking to people, which is what I do on a regular basis.
Well, how about the Ukrainians who are the Russian civilian Ukrainians who have given statements about what they lived through with the shelling of their schools and the killing of their children? I can't believe you're calling that a conspiracy theory.
I don't define people based on their blood or ethnicity, some kind of weird nationalistic thing. There are Ukrainian citizens. These are people who have...
Okay. Well,
the Bandera supporters inside the military do use racial definitions. And that's one of the reasons they continue to attack the people in the Donbas. And that is not a conspiracy theory. And if you're saying
All right, let's
that,
move on.
I think it is.
Let's move on to
something
that...
I think if you're talking
about
somebody who died 80 years ago as leading an army, I think that's a conspiracy theory.
Andrzej Dobrianski, let's move on to another issue, which is something that even the Ukrainian president has realized was a problem. Can you guess what that is?
No.
Okay. Corruption.
Exactly. Okay, so what's going on with the corruption scandal? 9 top officials... And, of course, the most high-profile one was the defense minister, if I'm not mistaken, and then a cabinet reshuffle. Or a government reshuffle. Do you see that being... Because Ukraine has been described as having a lot of corruption in it. It's been described. I can come up with some sources. First of all, what do you think of that? How far-reaching is the corruption that has come about, based on the aid, at least, just that portion of it?
I think when certain people mention that they can find sources citing Ukraine's corruption, normally that refers to decades-old or years-old information, especially prior to this full-fledged aggression, as well as prior to the revolution in 2014. If you look at international corruption indices, you'll actually see that Ukraine's invader, is actually ranked higher on a scale of corruption than Ukraine. That's just a known stated fact. As to what's happening in Ukraine, no, the defense minister hasn't been reshuffled. There was an early report out. Somebody tried to jump the gun and saying, absolutely, he's being moved out. Defense Minister Reznikov has said that's not the case. It's still not the case. And in terms of what happened in Ukraine, it's actually a standard of anti-corruption that most countries would be jealous of. I would be jealous of that here in the United States if there was a scandal that came out in the press and 3 days later, the scandal being that some prices for eggs bought for the military were high, some prices for wheat were low, and who was making money off of this. Within 4 days, numerous officials in the defense ministry were relieved from their positions and taken under investigation. That is a standard that many Western countries cannot match, nor is that something you would ever see in Russia.
Hardy Schlanger.
Well, that's because you're the recipient of hundreds of billions of dollars from the West. Now, I'll give you a couple of sources that have cited corruption since 2014. The Panama Papers, Transparency International, which is one of the most authoritative institutions looking into corruption, lists Ukraine as the most corrupt country in Europe. Now, you can take that up with them. I'm just saying that what we're looking at is a regime which is going around asking for billions of dollars and was unwilling to provide the normal papers and normal accounting procedures that governments would take. That's why there's a corruption scandal. And Zelensky is going to use this reshuffling or the alleged reshuffling to say to his Western partners, look, we're trying to deal with this. Don't hold back the money. We'll take care of it. I think that's not a conspiracy theory. I think you have to look at that quite as a serious problem.
All right. My last question to each of you. First, to you, Andriy Dobryansky. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Russia was building up its troops to take revenge because of this one-year anniversary coming up, or one-year, not anniversary, but marking the time when this operation took place. You called Russia a paper tiger. I'm curious as to whether a paper tiger with in possession of so many nuclear warheads should be called that.
Oh, absolutely. They've been using the fear-mongering of nuclear warheads for decades, as actually almost as soon as President Putin came to power. He's talked about launching nuclear weapons at Poland, against Turkey, against a whole slate of nations. He's never used them. We don't even know if they work. So, in terms of what's happening, people are actually dying, and those should be addressed before we talk about these figments of Putin's imagination.
All right. Hardy Schlanger, in response to our guest there. Less than a minute, please.
Well, I think what we're going to see is that it's not a paper tiger. If it's such a paper tiger, why do you need $100 billion of American taxpayers' money to send weapons to you? I mean, this is a fraudulent conception you're presenting. No one wants to see war. No one wants to see killing. But the question is, will Zelensky sit down with a clean slate and talk with Putin? This is what Pope Francis has requested. He's offered the Vatican as a venue. And I haven't heard anyone in Ukraine say they're willing to do that yet. The Russians said they would be willing to do that.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. It was a great discussion. Andriy Dobryansky, Chair of UN Affairs, Ukrainian World Congress from New York, thank you. And Hardy Schlanger, thank you. Schiller Institute, Germany, Potsdam, Germany is where he spoke to us from. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Vitagvay and the team. It's goodbye.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? The This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. so-called law enforcement has killed at least 1,176 people, or about 100 people a month, last year, making it the deadliest for police violence. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, law enforcement officers killed an average of 3 people per day, but faced more violence in the line of duty. Cops in the U.S. killed 1,176 people in 2022, making last year the deadliest on record, according to a nonprofit group that tracks police violence. However, officers faced more attempts on their own lives as crime in some cities soared to new heights. Mapping Police Violence, a project connected to the Black Lives Matter movement, found that police fatally shot, beat, tased, and restrained 31 more people last year than in 2021, when they killed 1,145 people. 2022's total of 1,176 is the highest annual tally since the nonprofit group began tracking such statistics in 2013. There were only 12 days without a single police killing last year. Officers killed an average of more than 3 people every day, the statistics show. 132 of these killings involved victims who hadn't been suspected of a crime, and 98 fatal encounters began as traffic stops. Some 24% of those killed were Black, despite Black people making up only 13% of the U.S. population. The violent crime rate in the U.S. has more than halved since 1993. However, violent offenses rose dramatically in some cities in the aftermath of 2020 Black Lives Matter protests, and officers have argued that liberal criminal justice reforms enacted after the police murder of George Floyd that year are costing them their lives. Also, Guardian reported law enforcement in the U.S. killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the U.S. since experts first started tracking the killings, and new data analysis has revealed. Police across the U.S. killed an average of more than 3 people a day, or nearly 100 people every month last year, according to Mapping Police Violence. The nonprofit research group maintains a database of reported deaths at the hands of law enforcement, including people fatally shot, beaten, restrained, and tasered. The preliminary 2022 total, a possible undercount as more cases are catalogued, marks 31 additional fatalities than the year before. In 2021, police killed 1,145 people, 1,152 in 2020, 1,097 in 2019, 1,140 in 2018, and 1,089 in 2017. The earliest data goes back to 2013, when advocates began counting these fatal incidents, a database run by the Washington Post, which tracks fatal shootings by police, also shows 2022 as a year with record killings. The data release comes 2 years after the murder of George Floyd sparked national uprisings calling for racial justice. police accountability and reductions in the funding and the size of police forces. Despite the international attention and some local efforts to curb police brutality, there has been an intensifying backlash to criminal justice reform, and the overall number of killings has remained alarmingly high. Bianca Austin, aunt of Biryono Taylor, whose March 2020 killing in Kentucky sparked mass protests, said, "It just never stops. There was a movement, an uproar across the globe, and we're still having more killings? What are we doing wrong? It's so disheartening." While the numbers have crept up, the circumstances that precede the killings have remained consistent. In 2022, 132 killings, 11% were cases in which no offense was alleged. 104 cases, 9% were mental health or welfare checks. 98, 8% involved traffic violations. And 207, 18% involved other allegations of nonviolent offenses. There were also 93 cases, 8% involving claims of a domestic disturbance, and 128, 11% where a person was allegedly seen with a weapon. Only 370, 31% involved a potentially more serious situation with an alleged violent crime. Samuel Seni Gua, a data scientist and policy analyst who founded Mapping Police Violence and provided 2022 data to The Guardian, said, "These are routine police encounters that escalate to a killing. The reduction in the conversation around police violence does not mean that the issue is going away. What's clear is that it's continuing to get worse and that it's deeply systematic. What's more, in 32% of cases last year, the person was fleeing before they were killed, generally running or driving off. Cases in which experts say lethal force is unwarranted and also endangers the public. In June, Ohio police officers fired dozens of rounds at Jalen Walker, who was unarmed and fleeing. A month later, an officer in California exited an unarmed car and immediately fired at Robert Adams as he ran in the opposite direction. The racial disparities have also persisted. Black people were 24% of those killed last year, while making up only 13% of the population. From 2013 to 2022, black residents were three times more likely to be killed by U.S. police than white people. The inequality is particularly severe in some cities, including Minneapolis, where police have killed black residents at a rate 28 times higher than white residents, and Chicago, where the rate was 25 times higher. Mapping Police Violence reported, police ability to be judge, jury, and executioner has been taken to another level. No matter how much we insist that it's wrong, society allows it to take place, said Jacob Blake Sr., whose son was shot by the Kenosha police and left paralyzed in 2020. Blake Sr. and Austin run a group called Families United that assists people whose loved ones have been killed by U.S. police. He also found that there had been a notable uptick in killings by sheriff's departments, which are generally county agencies run by an elected leader. In 2022, sheriffs were involved in 416 killings, higher than the share in 2013, which was 277 cases. It's unclear what's driving that increase, though experts say there had been growing partnerships between sheriffs and other agencies, with deputies executing search warrants or doing chases that can result in death. Sheriff's offices are also particularly politicized during elections, which could contribute to the problem. He said there are campaigns in which there is a race to the bottom to compete, to be more tough on crime. And the result is more violent sheriff's departments.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.